musician Rob Klyda there, live from Studio S here on WKAR's Current State, on his cittern. That's called a cittern, Rob?
Cittern, yes.
It looks like, I mean, if I had to describe it to somebody who's never seen the instrument before, and I am one of those people, I have not seen a cittern until today. It's kind of a outsized mandolin.
A mandolin on steroids.
It's a, okay. You've described it that way before, I can tell.
Yes.
Rob Klyda of The Lash providing live music here today on a Live Music Friday from WKAR. And we will hear more from Rob throughout the course of the hour here on Current State. Glad you're along here on Friday. For about a week, sex education has been one hot topic in the Lansing area. It began last week when Alice Drager, an author, college professor, and activist, live tweeted from her son's sex ed class at East Lansing High School. Among the quotes from the instructors, according to Drager, safe sex is kind of a misnomer, and you'll find a good girl. If you find one that says no, that's the one you want. Drager and many others on social media blasted the approach for being outdated, unconcerned with credible data, and focused on fear and shame. Michigan schools that teach sex education are legally obligated to include a unit on abstinence. But what is the right way to go about it? What ought to be included in an instruction on abstinence? What ought to be omitted? For their thoughts, we turn to two guests. Judy Keeler's been a member of the Reproductive Health Advisory Committee in the East Lansing School District. She's in her third year in that role. Welcome, Judy. And Wendy Sellers trains educators in reproductive health. She's taught hundreds of sex educators over the years, many of whom are now working in schools in Ingham, Eaton, and Clinton counties. Welcome, Wendy.
Thank you.
Clarify the landscape for us a little bit, Wendy. How can are schools obligated to teach sex ed in Michigan?
Yes, Michigan law does require that abstinence is taught as part of a sex ed program, and that's been the law for many years.
But are schools obligated to teach sex ed in the first place?
No.
Or can they opt out of that?
Michigan law does not require sex ed to be taught. It is allowed, and if schools do teach sex ed, there are some strict criteria they have to follow in order to teach sex education.
Okay, but abstinence has to be a part of the instruction if they choose to educate kids about sex.
Exactly.
Okay. Besides abstinence, what else can be taught?
Schools are required to teach young people how to reduce their risk of having sexual activity and also refusal skills. They have to teach them the laws of Michigan related to sexual behavior and many other components that have to be included in that instruction. And it has to be medically accurate.
But broadly speaking, the units then are abstinence and, would you say, risk reduction? Is that how all the other stuff is basically identified?
The law does not specify what has to be taught in those terms. It's up to local control. So each school district that teaches sex ed in Michigan has to have a sex ed advisory board made up of parents, educators, clergy, medical personnel, and students. And they make recommendations about what is taught and how. And then the local school board has to either approve or change those recommendations. And once the school board approves that curriculum, that is what is taught in that district.
So there's a fair amount of local control when it comes into how a district addresses this.
Very much so.
And Judy Keeler, you are a member of that committee that Wendy just referred to in the East Lansing School District, correct?
Correct.
Now, in East Lansing, kids have a unit on abstinence, but the risk reduction piece is also a part of it. So both of those are addressed. Do you personally think that both abstinence and risk reduction should be included?
I absolutely do believe that both should be included. Not everyone subscribes to being abstinent, so we really want to make sure that our youth are protected.
How do you feel about districts that only teach abstinence?
Well, I think that every district should have the right to make their own decisions because we live in a diverse community, a diverse world. For instance, what is acceptable in Holland, they may have more religious-based or different beliefs or different kids from different countries than what we have here. In East Lansing, we have over 40 countries represented, which means you have diverse cultures, religions, values, and mores, and we have to respect that.
Wendy Sellers, are there different outcomes for districts that only teach abstinence? I mean, do we know about the outcomes there?
Yes, we do. There's a lot of research on this topic. It's been hotly debated, and everything in education has to be based on data. And so if we look at the data, by the time seniors graduate from high school, approximately half of them have already had sexual intercourse at least once. And so if we look at the data, if we only teach abstinence, we're not meeting the needs of all of our students, because education is for life. And high school may be the last chance that young people get to learn about sexual behavior and how to reduce their risk. And so the research shows that schools that teach only abstinence, not only does it not delay sexual intercourse, but when young people do finally have sexual intercourse, they're more likely to become pregnant and to get sexually transmitted infections.
Talk to us a little bit about how you instruct teachers with regard to the abstinence piece, though. What exactly do you teach?
Well, I train teachers how to increase their comfort and confidence in talking about sexual topics with their students. I teach them about the laws in Michigan related to sex education. And as far as abstinence, I encourage them not to use the term abstinence, because the word abstinence means different things to different people. So we talk about the fact that young people are very concrete thinkers, and if we're going to instruct them in meaningful ways how to delay sexual behavior, we need to talk in very concrete and specific terms. Teaching kids to delay sex is most effective if we teach them all those skills before they begin having sex. So we need to start those conversations earlier rather than later.
And does teaching about abstinence, is there a consensus that teaching kids about abstinence should not include inducing guilt or fear about it?
I would say there's not consensus, because there are still programs that rely pretty heavily on stereotyped messages about not having sex based on whether you're male or female. There are still programs that emphasize condom risk failure rates rather than encouraging young people to eliminate those failure rates by using condoms consistently and correctly, in which case they are 98% to 99% effective. And so I would say there's not consensus, because some programs still do rely on more fear-based tactics than we would prefer kids to hear.
We're talking about how to teach abstinence in sex education here in Michigan. Our guests are Wendy Sellers, who helps train teachers in teaching reproductive health. Judy Keeler is a member of the East Lansing School District's Reproductive Health Advisory Committee. Judy, you've told me you are a critic of shame-based or fear-based sex ed instruction. In your view, does the SMART curriculum, that's Sexually Mature, Aware, Responsible Teens, the SMART curriculum that East Lansing has used for many years, do you feel that the SMART curriculum includes shame-based or fear-based messages?
Well, I'll first tell you that I do not believe in using fear or guilt or shame, but I do truly believe that people need to be educated in the consequences. They should be taught what the consequences are of the decisions that they make. Regarding the SMART curriculum, I have not reviewed it in detail, and I was not there the day of the presentation, so I am not comfortable commenting one way or another. And I would defer that to Wendy, because I know that she is familiar with the SMART curriculum.
Tell us about what you know about the SMART curriculum, Wendy.
Well, my knowledge of the SMART curriculum is more historic than current. I've known about the SMART program for probably 20 years or more. We worked together on an Ingham County Abstinence Coalition in the past, and I know that they're very well-intentioned. One of the hallmarks of the program is they have slightly older students, usually college-age students, do testimonials about the negative outcomes and consequences of sexual behavior that they've had. And they also do a dice game where they toss the dice, and then depending on what number you roll, you end up being pregnant. Unfortunately, sometimes the messages that are delivered are not as effective as they could be using those two strategies.
I want to return to those strategies in just a few minutes, but Judy, I want to, we are getting some messages on social media, both Twitter and Facebook. And Judy, I want to address with you, it seems like people's awareness of the SMART program and its methods have become a lot more apparent since this situation a week ago. As a member of this Reproductive Health Advisory Committee, do you feel you were as aware of the SMART approach as you should have been? Aaron Graham is tweeting us here this morning. Was the Reproductive Health Committee aware of the SMART program? Were they aware that Pregnancy Services of Greater Lansing was coming in?
With the Reproductive Health Committee, what we do is we're responsible for making recommendations from kindergarten through high school or 12th grade. So what happens is we review the different elements, because obviously we don't teach the kindergartners the same things that we teach the 12th graders. So it has been done on a rotational method. So we have, I have not seen the SMART program as of yet, but that was our next segment, because we, you know, do K through 6, 6 through 8, and then 9 through 12. So I've not been exposed to that curriculum.
But given your opposition to shame-based or fear-based messages, how much concern do you have about the SMART program being in the East Lansing School District? I mean, Nell Kuhnmensch, the president of the school board, told Judy Putnam of the Gannett newspapers the other day that she expects the SMART program to really to not be a part of the for the district to move and remove the SMART program from East Lansing. From what you've learned about their methods just in the past week, how concerned are you about these alleged fear and guilt-based messages that SMART has in its approach?
Well, Mark, I'm concerned because we have to remember, first of all, that we are exposed to this through Alice's tweets, and Alice has definite biases. So I was not there, so I'm not comfortable accepting what she says as being 100%. I think, yes, we should review it, we should look at it, yes, but I can't make my decisions based on one person's tweets.
Wendy Sellers, to what extent does a responsible sex health educator acknowledge that sex is pleasurable to a class of 12-year-olds or 13-year-olds, let's say? How explicit is a responsible educator about that message?
Well, you have raised a very hotly debated topic, Mark. Most sex educators would rather not ever admit that sex is pleasurable to students of any age. And yet, as parents and as responsible community members, if we're honest with ourselves, wouldn't we eventually like to know that our children have a wonderful sex life at the right time, with the right person, in the right circumstances? And yet, much of our sex ed programming teaches sex as something to be feared, something with lots of negative consequences, rather than equipping our young people to have a great adult sex life. Mm. And so this is a really difficult topic. How do we find the balance between communicating that, yes, indeed, sex can be pleasurable? That's why more than 95% of people eventually do have sex. And most of those people do usually have sex before they get married, without encouraging kids to run right out and try it, which is the fear that we as adults have. Mm. If kids find out it's pleasurable, they might want to run right out and have sex before we think they're ready. Mm. That's our fear.
Alice Drager has tweeted the program here this morning with a question for you, Judy Keeler. She asks, is it true you have pulled your kids from East Lansing Public School sex ed?
I have one son, and yes, early on, when we first came to the district, we did excuse our child from the sex education portion, and that's due to the fact that we wanted to educate him based on our values and our beliefs, and I needed to know what was being taught. As a responsible parent, I feel that I need to know what my child is being exposed to. So yes, I did, but my son has been going through, and so he has been exposed to it since.
One thing at the heart of this story seems to be how unaware many people are of how sex ed is taught in their community schools. Many people were surprised by Alice Drager's tweets. Neil Kuhnmensch, as I said, of the East Lansing School Board, has acknowledged the SMART curriculum had been used for many years, and she said, and this is very close to a quote, if not a quote, none of us were particularly aware of it. Should the wider public be paying more attention to how sex ed is taught in their district. Wendy?
Absolutely, and I think that is the really positive thing about the circumstances of the last week, and that is that it has brought this topic to the public's awareness, and it has promoted some conversations that really need to happen. I think that communities, and especially parents of children who are in schools, really need to take an active interest. Parents have a lot of power in helping equip their young people for delaying sex until the right time, and that right time is really formulated by family values and spiritual beliefs and many other circumstances. And so the more parents are involved in those conversations with their children, the better the outcomes. And so I'm really thrilled that these conversations have been brought to everyone's awareness right now.
Last word. Judy, are you going to be looking closer at the SMART program in East Lansing? Are you going to be taking a closer look at that and learning more about it?
As my role on the committee, yes, I will. But I wanted to also point out that parents do have, by law, the right to view the information. We do contact parents and let them know that the information is available. So the district has not done anything incorrect. We have availed parents of that information. So I just want to make that clear. And we also have a process in place for expressing concerns or making recommendations. So I want people to understand that the district has been open and forefront on this.
How often does the committee meet? That'll be my last question. We're out of time. How often does the Reproductive Health Committee meet?
We in the past have met 2 to 3 times a year.
Okay. Wendy Sellers trains educators in reproductive health. She is with Eaton County RESA. Our other guest here today, Judy Keeler, has been a member of the Reproductive Health Advisory Committee in the East Lansing School District. We'll probably have you back and talk about this again. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Thanks.
I love that sound. That's the sound of a cittern in the hands of Rob Clyda, our special guest, a member of the Lash, whose last concert is tonight. They're calling the show One Last Paycheck, and that's at the Avenue Cafe in Lansing. Jen Siggett will open the show at 9 o'clock. More from Rob Clyda here on a Live Music Friday on WKAR's Current State. Before the end of the hour, there's a lot to see at the Detroit Zoo: polar bears, giraffes, and crocodiles. But there's also a lot that you don't see, like all the poop from the animals. So what happens to the animal waste from all those lions and tigers and bears? Well, at the Detroit Zoo, it will soon be turned into electricity. The zoo is currently raising money for a brand new biodigester to capture the leftover energy in its animal waste. Current State's April Van Buren talked to Jerry Van Acker, the zoo's chief operating officer. He said that while poop might not be the first thing on your mind during a visit to the zoo, it's really an important part of the zoo's day-to-day operations.
It's really a big deal. I mean, we have a full crew that goes around every morning. The keepers are in the exhibits cleaning up, and then we collect it in waste cans. And then 3 times a week, the landscape crew spends about 3 hours Monday, Wednesday, Friday morning collecting the waste cans.
And about how much animal waste does the zoo have to deal with on a daily basis?
Well, annually it's 400 tons. So each day, gosh, that would probably be about 3 tons a day, 6,000 pounds.
Wow.
it's a pretty major problem, really. The current way we do it is, we collect it in kind of like a trash hauling vehicle, and there's a business downtown that takes it, and they compost it for urban gardening.
Well, I want to move on to what you guys are planning to do with the waste next, which is a really cool idea. You guys are raising money to buy a biodigester, and I was wondering if you could tell me just a little bit about what a biodigester is, kind of how it would work.
Yeah, a biodigester, actually what it does is takes the remaining energy left in the food that's the animal's waste. There's still about 45% energy left in the animal waste. So what we do is collect that, and we put it in a cell, and it's, if you can imagine, like a quick oil change garage, that size. So it's a cell about that big, and we have four of those, one for each week of the month. So we collect it for a week, and we close the doors, and there has to be sealed very, very tightly, because once you close it and you heat up the compost and spray a leachate on it, it begins the process of breaking it down with all the biological elements that break down waste. So once that starts breaking down, it produces methane. And the methane is gathered in a bladder on top of the building. And then when we get enough methane in the bladder, it starts a diesel generator, and the diesel generator produces electricity.
And I have to ask, is there going to be an issue with smell? I mean, you mentioned three
Not
tons of manure a day.
No, the doors will be closed all the time. I mean, the only issue with smell would be when you've got the doors open and you're dumping. But once it sits in there for 28 days and all the germs break down the manure, it really has no smell at all. It's like a kind of like a peat moss material you'd buy at a Home Depot or a Lowe's or something like that.
Jerry Van Acker is the Chief Operating Officer at the Detroit Zoological Society. We're talking about the zoo's plan to buy a biodigester to turn their animal waste into energy. It's not just animal waste that's going to go into this biodigester, too. Is this something that can take other kinds of waste, things like food waste that might be generated on a daily basis at the zoo?
It will. It'll take our landscaping waste, and eventually, not initially, but eventually it'll take our organic food waste as well. So we'll have about 400 tons initially with the animal waste, and we can take it up to about 550 tons with additional waste.
How much energy will, 400 tons of animal waste is a lot, but how much energy comes out of that much input?
Well, it'll be about $70,000 to $80,000 worth of electricity each year, and it's going to be enough to power about 75% of our animal health complex. So it's kind of interesting that the waste from animals is going to help to power their care.
In total, what does a biodigester like this cost?
Roughly around $1 million, and we were fortunate enough to have the Herb Family Foundation fund $600,000. And then we've got grant proposals into the state for about another $200,000. And the zoo is going to pay $100,000 towards the project. But then the last $100,000 we're trying to raise through crowdfunding and through the Patronicity website.
And I'm wondering how you make that appeal to people. You know, it's kind of a quirky idea when you first hear about it, but how do you make that pitch that this is worth investing in?
Well, they're really investing in a couple things. The first thing, they're investing in our future, you know, investing in Mother Earth and sustainability and not requiring so much of the carbon footprint. And then secondly, they're actually investing in the future of the zoo. This will be a project that will save money for the zoo for many, many years to come, and it'll help support the zoo and keep it as the, really, it's the largest cultural attraction in the state of Michigan. We'll do about 1.5 million visitors this year. And there are no other cultural attractions in Michigan that attract that type of audience. So it helps the zoo along.
Jerry Van Acker is the Chief Operating Officer for the Detroit Zoological Society. We've been talking about the zoo's plans to turn poop into power with a new energy-producing biodigester. Thanks so much for talking to me, Jerry.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's really been great, April.
For Current State, this is April Van Buren.
I'll be the pain that needs your Novocaine and a glimmer in your eye. I'll take the rust out of your trust. You'd believe me if I said I'll never be the dish who makes you wish you'd eaten somewhere else instead. The friends you make on the way up
by the friends that are gonna last. They'll be there on the downhill slide, and they'll be there when you crash.
One of the founding members of The Lash, which is having its last live performance tonight at the Avenue Cafe in Lansing. We've been enjoying Rob Klyda on the Cittern here today on WKAR's Current State. More from Rob coming up, a full song performance and a little conversation as well. It's Current State on WKAR. Our next guest is the newest member of the Lansing City Council, but he doesn't plan to stay too long. Vincent Delgado was appointed to the council in February to fill the remaining term vacated by Derek Quinney, who left the post after his election as Ingham County Register of Deeds. Delgado has decided not to run for re-election in the August 4th primary. His term will end January 1st. Vince Delgado's day job is as Assistant Dean for Civic Engagement at Michigan State University. He's also the co-founder of the Refugee Development Center in Lansing. I asked him why, after just 2 months on the council, he's decided not to seek re-election.
Two things happened. First, my two-year-old son, Diego, has a good friend who's an eight-year-old that comes around the house, and she's his favorite kid. And so he calls her, because he's just learning to talk, he calls her Hi Danielle. And we will always laugh about it because he adds the hi to it. But she always comes, and he's always anticipating her coming. After a while, just within the first month of me working on council, my name became Bye Papa, because he's always anticipating me leaving.
Oh, how about that?
And even if I'm there for a long time, it's become my name. So that's something that kind of hits you right there, you know. And so that was one thing that happened. And another thing that happened in terms of considering this is I had a really interesting conversation with one of my colleagues who works in civic engagement in the arts. And we were talking about something else, but we were talking about social responsibility. And she said, you know, people forget that our first social responsibility, whether we're a parent, an uncle, an aunt, a brother or a sister, is raising good citizens. And I thought to myself, if I'm here working in the city and I love to serve, but I'm not there to raise good citizens within my own family, and I need to be there.
You were quoted in a recent Lansing State Journal article as saying you want to focus this year on two specific issues. Let's take them one at a time. The first is predatory lending. This, of course, is the practice by some lenders, businesses, of charging subprime interest rates. How widespread is that in our area?
In our discussions, we found that a significant percentage of the folks that have to go to the Financial Empowerment Center to get assistance have somehow been touched by predatory lending, that they're paying fees that continue. They might even have the principal paid off, but they're actually paying fees and loans on the fees and loans. And it is a significant issue in our region, particularly following the Great Recession.
What do you think can be done about that?
Well, there's a couple of things, and they're kind of two-sided, right? You can certainly use the stick. And there's some things you can do perhaps around zoning in thinking about how close do particular lenders, how close can they be to one another. If you go down Cedar Street in South Lansing, you will see quite a few locations that it could be said are engaging in predatory lending practices kind of every couple of blocks. So you can do some things with zoning. Other communities have done that. However, the issue with that is typically these lending organizations kind of stay one step ahead, right? So another option is the carrot. Is there a way, and certainly the Financial Empowerment Center has identified lenders and financial service organizations that engage in practices that are actually very helpful for people that are struggling. However, a lot of these places are a 1.5-hour bus ride out of town. So how do we get them to come into the city and be near the people that need these types of services the most? That could be something that our public institutions can be involved, perhaps leasing small little spaces or areas in which people can access these services. And that's something we can work on.
We're talking with Vincent Delgado, an at-large Lansing City Councilman. The other issue you're passionate about is making City Hall and other public spaces safe for all residents. There was an incident I believe in January, where a man was picked up by officials from ICE, the Federal Immigration Customs and Enforcement Division, while he was at Lansing City Hall on other business. You've got many different people at City Hall for different reasons, and their proximity to each other may be problematic. What's the solution there?
Well, I think there's a couple of different solutions in there. Certainly, we need to continue to engage in negotiations with ICE and see what we can do about ensuring that our public spaces are not seen as places where you can get picked up and taken away when you're trying to do business. So I want to make sure that we continue to engage in negotiations and come to some clear agreements on access and notice and those kinds of things.
Vincent Delgado is an at-large Lansing City Councilman. He's just announced he will not seek re-election to the council this year. His term ends in January. Vincent Delgado, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much.
In every town I was bred and born, in Stephen's Green now I'll die in scorn. I made my life in saddle and trade. I turn out to be roving blade. I turned out to be a roving blade. At 17, I took a wife. I loved her dearly as I loved my life. And for to keep her in fine array, I went robbing on the king's highway. I went robbing on the king's highway.
Nice. Rob Clyda on the Cittern here, live from Studio S at WKAR East Lansing on a Live Music Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. We think of Michigan as the center of the auto industry, but there have been times in our history when production of recreational boats was a thriving industry as well. In fact, many of the best-known boat names, like Chriscraft, originated here. Current State's Melissa Benmark has more. I like the way you think about spring and summer here. It's nice to do a segment about boats.
Well, yeah, people will be taking theirs out here pretty quick when the weather gets a little bit nicer. And I talked to author Scott Peters about boating. He's the curator of collections at the Michigan Historical Museum, and his book is called Making Waves, Michigan's Boat Building Industry, 1865 to 2000. It's published by the University of Michigan Press. When I thought about small boats in Michigan, you know, my mind's eye instantly went to, you know, the canoes full of furs for the fur trade, that kind of thing, working boats. In the mid-1800s, boats started to be used more for recreation.
It really starts up after the Civil War, when people start getting a little bit more leisure time, and also the revenues, the job wages become a little bit higher. And if you're a salaried professional or something like that, you have the money and also the time to spend on leisure. And it's further complicated with people being able to access trains going north in Michigan. We have access to the recreation areas, bigger lakes and that kind of thing.
I understand that early on it wasn't so much that people were individual boat owners as that you would go to a boat livery and rent one.
Yeah, that was a pretty common practice where people, if they wanted to go out for a day's ride, they would rent a boat and get some brief instructions on how to use it. It might have been a sailing boat or just a rowboat of one kind or another. But sometimes they had small launches, either a steam launch or a gasoline launch, to tow you to the favorite fishing grounds, and you'd have a whole string of boats that would go that way.
Michigan, of course, is known for building autos. Talk about the interaction a little bit of you know, some of the auto manufacturing expertise creeping into boat building.
Well, boats really made a good thing to start on building engines with. They were excellent test beds because the early automobile engines and any kind of gasoline engine in the early years was really, really heavy. And so a boat could support that weight, and they could test them out and try different ideas with them, with the different cylinder sizes. The speeds would go up gradually as they became more proficient at building the engines.
I understand that outboard motors first were popularized by a Michigan man who got the idea kind of from his motorcycle?
Yeah, Cameron Waterman. He was an interesting fellow where he was actually going to Yale and was on their rowing team over there and became interested in motorcycle driving. But also when the end of the season came for driving around the motorcycle, he took it off and put it in his chair in his dorm room and hung it on the back of his chair, and came up with the idea of, well, maybe I could do that with a boat. And they took the motorcycle engine, attached a propeller and shaft to it, and also a chain drive, and tested it out on the cold waters of the Detroit River one day. The boat's engine was nicknamed Coughing Sarah by the other people in the party that he was going out with, but they successfully tested the first outboard engine in Michigan here.
And then since he was a patent lawyer, he kind of got some of the patent stuff straightened out to his own advantage.
Yeah, to a point. I mean, he could never really patent the whole thing, and so he became unsuccessful in that over the long haul. But other people, Ollie Evinrude and others, picked up the idea and carried it forward. At one time, there were numerous outboard engine manufacturers here in the state also that took that same idea and carried it forward.
Bootlegging, apparently, during Prohibition was a big deal, and I didn't realize, of course, that part of that was because of proximity to Canada. They called it the Detroit Windsor Funnel. Talk about the role that speedboats played in illegal whiskey distribution.
Well, it was really good for the boat builders to have Prohibition because they could supply both sides of the industry, both the law enforcement side and also the rum runners themselves. Everybody wanted a fast boat for different reasons. And the boat building community in the greater Detroit area and also up and down the St. Clair River and other places around the country, too, were looking to provide people with fast boats. And we had what was called the Detroit Windsor Funnel, which was sort of a takeoff on the Detroit Windsor Tunnel, obviously. But law enforcement was trying to intercept something on the order of a volume of 2,500 cases a day coming across the river. And usually what they had was a small boat, usually underpowered. The rum runners could drive circles around them, generally speaking. And so it was kind of a lose-lose situation for the law enforcement folks. But it also promoted wanting a fast boat and another reason for speed.
Listeners will recognize the name Garwood and Chris Craft. Those boat companies got their start here.
That's right. Garwood was actually a racer. He was actually better known for an invention that he made of the hydraulic dump truck hoist, the thing that tips the dump truck bodies over to dump the load of dirt. And that's how he made his fortune and eventually got into boat racing. His father owned a boat up in Minnesota that was a small passenger steamer, and he served on that as a kid. And then in his adult life, he became a boat racer and led the way in developing really, really fast boats. He became the world water speed record holder numerous times, competed against other boat drivers internationally, and also won a race called the Gold Cup numerous times.
Definitely a lot of boom and bust in the cycles of boat making. But during World War II, it sounds like there was quite a boom with Michigan producing landing boats for amphibious invasion.
Chris Craft was one of the largest manufacturers of landing craft for the war effort. And in fact, if it wasn't for Chris Craft, we wouldn't have had the ability to invade the islands in the Pacific or even Europe. At that
Omaha
time.
Beach.
Yeah,
and
Omaha
such
Beach,
like that,
right.
Yeah.
And so it was the landing craft that were built there. They were also larger scale landing boats that were built by the Defoe Company up in Bay City. And between these different kinds of landing craft and also the support vessels around them that helped mark the waterways and all, a lot of them were small boats that were built in Michigan.
And it sounds like that was maybe the height of it. It sounds like there are a lot smaller builders and a lot fewer now, really, since the war.
Yeah, we lost a number of boat builders right after the war. I think there were five major ones that we lost at that time. And they were probably making boats that the public didn't want anymore based on older designs from the pre-war era and also pre-war materials. And we have a lot of the industrial stylists in the auto industry that were coming up with new ways of things to look and appear, and that's what the buying customer really wanted.
So in the course of researching for this book, do you think there might be any new trends coming to Michigan in terms of the recreational boat industry or new ideas?
I think the change in materials is always going to be something that's constantly sort of out there. Also, I think going back to customization and making boats more identifiable by individuals, when we have mass marketing and the ways that we do now where anybody can buy anything, but there it's all pretty uniform. I think there's probably going to be a trend towards customization in the distant future anyway.
Do you boat?
I do. I've got a little aluminum rowboat with a small little outboard engine, but going out this weekend, so it should be some fun.
Well, Scott Peters, thank you so much for joining us.
I really appreciate it, Melissa. Thanks for the invitation.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. For 20 years, Lansing music fans have enjoyed what's been described as the Celtic mayhem of The Lash. Tonight, the group will perform for the last time. They're calling the show One Last Paycheck. It's at the Avenue Cafe in Lansing. Jen Siggett will open the show at 9 p.m. Rob Clyda is the last founding member of The Lash, still in the band, and he's our Live Music Friday guest today. We'll talk with Rob here in a few minutes about music and The Lash, but here is Rob right now performing Don't Blame It on the Whiskey.
La-da-da-da-da-da-da. 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 Blame the horses for sinking me in debt. I can't fault their mighty muscles for the pounding in my chest. Deep in uncharted waters with a rock upon my neck. I've taken every paradox and I put it to the test. Yes, see, they framed Picasso for looking past the lines. And I wonder if his alibi was opium or wine. I know it's been the downfall of many other men. But don't blame it on the whiskey, cause the whiskey's still my friend. Don't blame it on the whiskey. Don't blame it on the whiskey. I know it's been a burden for many other men, but don't blame it on the whiskey, cause the whiskey's still my friend. La da 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 da. La da 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 da. La da 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 da. La 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 la. Well, the bets have all been hammered and the losers scurry home. No greater field of glory have they likely ever known than to lose a whole week's wages on some unrewarding roan. It's a chance to dance with destiny but still go home alone. You see, they frame Picasso for looking past the lines. And I wonder if his alibi was opium or wine. I know it's been the downfall of many other men, but don't blame it on the whiskey. The whiskey's still my friend. Don't blame it on the whiskey. Don't blame it on the whiskey. I know it's been a burden for many other men, but don't blame it on the whiskey, cause the whiskey's still my friend. La da 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 da. La da 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 da. La da 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 la.
Nice ending there. I like the way that
Thank
changed.
You,
you ain't worth the whiskey. It's Rob Clyda here on WKAR's Current State on a Live Music Friday. Welcome. It's been
Thank you.
Great
Thanks for
to
having
hear
me.
You here this morning. Can you do Celtic music without referring to alcohol? I guess that's...
I don't think you can do it without referring to alcohol and or fighting, preferably both.
Just, you know, you just performed that song. That is the second song that overtly involves whiskey that has been heard on this program in like a week or so. Riley Bulla, who is a football player here at Michigan State, is an aspiring country music artist, and he performed a bit of You Ain't Worth the Whiskey.
You'll find whiskey is a great inspiration to
it
many
is,
people.
It has inspired a lot of songs. How far afield from Celtic music do you go, Rob, and how far afield from Celtic music does The Lash go?
The Lash goes every place. I mean, very, very far afield. I mean, when we started out, we were strictly Celtic and actually Irish rock, and we just branched out. We do Cajun, Celtic, country, and other things that start with C's, I guess. rock, bluegrass. You know, we go wherever we want to go now.
You sound like a perfect fit for the East Lansing or the Great Lakes Folk Festival.
I would think so. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you played there?
No, we have not.
Well, that sounds like an oversight to me. But
I think so too.
20 years is a long time. A lot of personnel changes in the band, and you're the last remaining original member.
I am the last one.
Why the breakup?
The breakup is because I just think that we've been around long enough. Period. And this is the lineup I wanted to go out with. I thought it was one of the best lineups we've ever had, and I want to just I don't want to fade away. I want to go out on a big high note with the lineup that I really like. And that's why I decided to do it now. It's an amicable decision with the band, but not necessarily a mutual one. It's just one I've been thinking about, and I thought this is the time.
What are your followers saying about the breakup of the group?
They don't like it.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's nice.
Take that as a compliment. Right?
But we've become that kind of band where we're playing in Lansing. People don't come to see us as much anymore because you can always go see The Lash. They're always playing somewhere. And so that's not going to be true anymore. So if you want to see The Lash, you come see us tonight.
That's right. The last, or One Last Paycheck is what the show is being called here tonight.
Or Jen Siggett says The Lashed Stand.
The Lashed Stand.
Yeah.
I like that. How far from Lansing has The Lash performed? Have you guys been around the country or what?
Yeah, the furthest gig we've played would be in Portland, Oregon. And we used to do the East Coast a lot, in New York, Connecticut, up in Pennsylvania, all over the place over there. And we used to have an agent who was in Chicago, so we did the whole Midwest circuit in the middle of the country all the time. We're driving from Chicago to Kansas City, back to Chicago, and going to somewhere else 600 miles away.
We're talking with Rob Klyda of The Lash on Live Music Friday here on WKAR's Current State. The Lash will do their last show after 20 years together tonight at the Avenue Cafe in Lansing. Is the split at all about wanting to do something different, though? Or is it really predicated by what you said earlier?
Yeah, well, there is an element of that. A friend of mine, Mike Lynch, who was the other founding member of the band, he was actually the founding member of the band, and I kind of helped him out, but he's been playing with everybody in the state, and he's like, I'm really getting tired of all this traveling. Do you want to start something new? And he asked me that about the same time that I was like looking at the calendar saying, I wonder when I can end The Lash. And so, yeah, there was that element to it, and we did start a new band called Drag Spell, and we played a few gigs already.
Drag Spell?
Drag Spell is actually Swedish for accordion. The correct pronunciation would be Dragspiel. We didn't think that would be good for radio, so we just go with Drag Spell. We anglicized it.
How does Drag Spell's sound differ most noticeably from the sound of The Lash?
A lot of people would say it doesn't, but I think that's because I'm singing all the songs and still playing the same instruments. But it is a little bit, it's more up-tempo. The Lash has gotten to be more of a folky kind of sound, I think, or even bluegrass. So Drag Spell is more rock. And as we start to write newer originals, and we're hoping to have an album out in the fall, I think it's going to be more in a world beat, like a heavier world beat kind of sound. Mm.
Do you have CDs out then?
The Lash has 3 CDs out. Yeah, okay. You can get them anywhere you can get CDs.
Do you like recording? Or you're done recording. Are you recording tonight?
No,
it's
we are
your
not
last
recording
concert.
Tonight. Nope, this is it. You have to be there live.
What drew you to Irish themes and Irish music in the first place, Rob? What did you hear first that said, I gotta go there?
I just liked that. I think the same thing I liked was that everybody liked when they first heard The Lash. It was just kind of foreign sounding, but still pleasant to hear. I mean, the scales and the patterns they sound simple, but they're really not. And when you hear it, you pick up on that. And it's just kind of exciting to hear it the first time.
Mm. Have you traveled to Ireland?
No, I haven't.
Never been?
No.
Was it ever a thought to actually have The Lash perform in Europe, at least, let's say?
Yeah, it was. And we've actually had people who approached us saying, we want to set up this tour. We want to take you to Ireland. And nothing ever came of it.
Joshua Davis, who was just blowing up on The Voice, has actually gigged with you guys a few times.
Yeah, he has. He went out to... We did a music conference called North by Northwest in Portland, Oregon, and he went out there with us and played mandolin, and he did a couple of shows in Chicago, and we've just always, stepping in it was, I think stepping in it formed about 2 months after the Lash, maybe, and we've just always, we've been friends.
Have you performed at the Avenue before?
Yes.
Okay.
The Lash has performed there for a 10-pound fiddle show.
Good venue, as far as you're concerned?
I like it, for the last show? Yeah.
Yeah. What's next for you, then? You've talked about Drag Spell. Sorry, mm-hmm. You have talked about that. But will there be other things on the side of that as
well? Yeah, I have another side band, actually, with Drew Howard and Jen Siggett and Lewis Redner on a stand-up bass called the Hopening Quartet. I have a solo album called Hopening, and so we do songs for that about 5 or 6 times a year. And then I do a lot of solo shows, but I'm just hoping to focus all my time into the new band.
Well, it's been a pleasure to have you here today, Rob. You sound great.
Oh, thank
and
you.
I'm sure tonight's going to just rock. After 20 years, The Lash performs its final Lansing show tonight at 9 o'clock at the Avenue Cafe. Jen Siggett opens the show. We want to thank our Live Music Friday guest, Rob Klyda. Many thanks for being here today. Rob, we're going to have you play us out after I remind our guests that Monday on Current State, if you skip breakfast, we've got you covered. A new exhibit at the Broad Art Museum called American Appetite looks at the evolution of American food culture in the 20th century. Plus, an MSU researcher thinks high blood pressure may be caused by your belly fat, which may be talking to blood vessels in your abdomen. We will try to explain that, and you will hear more Monday on Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. We're glad you could join us today. Rob Klyda plays us out on Current State.
Nine alive little lion's heart, sly and caught and committed to the art of professional and pointless investigation. Any excuse for recreation, now is the time for an impromptu nap. Sleep for a while, then up for a snack. Kings and queens of every nation, in a little cat's imagination. Cat's imagination. Every shadow a possible threat, any noise, every footstep, possible danger in every situation. Paranoia, too much concentration, patiently lying in wait for the prey. Mindless aggravation is all in the day. The conflicts and struggles of every nation are wrapped up in a cat's imagination. Cat's imagination.